ever have a moment, like, does your phone ever run out of batteries because you used all of the battery of your phone, or do you plug it in every night and, like, recharge it? Or because I used to be the type of person whose phone never ran out of batteries, but now it happens all the time.
My phone rarely dies, and it's not
because it has great battery life, or because you plug it in every night because you're a responsible adult human being.
Well, it's a little bit of both, because it is one of the. It's not that I remember to plug it in every night. It's that all the many different iterations of the phone that I upgrade to has given me this opportunity to amass a certain amount of chargers. So I have a charger at my bedside on my nightstand.
Yeah, that's what it's called. Yep.
I have one in my book bag.
Uh-huh.
I have a charger plugged up on my desk.
Right.
And I have a car charger.
So the availability of opportunities to charge your phone isn't restricted to just at night.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if I'm at home about to pass out and I have 60% battery,
yep.
I don't concern myself with reaching and digging for that plug, and I just throw it. I just throw the phone on a nightstand and pass out.
Yeah. Understood. Well, I feel like the reason I am constantly running out of batteries now is because I got a new phone and it has a non-micro USB port. Like, you know, most phones now have micro USB as the charger port.
Yeah.
Well, this phone is a Motorola phone and it doesn't have...
It's proprietary?
Yes.
Oh.
And so I only have one charger for it. And if that's not on me, then I'm screwed. So... My phone just ran out of batteries.
Oh, my God.
It's like such a childish feeling when you're like, well, I guess I set myself up for that one.
Well, we may be sounding different this week.
Ooh.
Because we, for the first time in Mocha Latte history, we have two microphones.
It only took 10 episodes.
we have a microphone of our own now.
Yeah.
We had a friend of ours say yesterday... We were asking for feedback, and she was like, is there a way where you can guys not sound like you're so far away? Or something like that.
Yeah. She said our voices sound far away, and that's because we didn't want to be cheek-to-cheek speaking into the same microphone. I mean...
Yeah. So now we have... I was able to get a hold of this mixer so we can have multiple channels.
That's great.
Two microphones. So, yeah, I don't know how this is going to sound. I'm hearing in my ear white noise.
Oh, no.
The mics sound good, but there's white noise.
Oh.
So,
well, if this turns out to be a bust, then we'll figure out something else.
This is all.
The listeners can't see what I'm seeing, but what's happening with that facial hair over there, Dante?
Dude,
it seems like you got a little twist going at the end of that mustache.
So, first I was just growing it out because I had to keep it the same because I was
for the show
for the Easter production, we filmed some segments, and I messed around and had a little scrub going.
Oh, and you had to keep
it. So I had to keep it.
Oh man,
because we filmed
what
parts
commitment
like weeks
to
before.
The craft, man.
I do what I can for the people.
Yeah,
I got to do what I can for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the show, I just was lazy.
Just keep it.
And now, so now it's like.
You got something going there.
My wife tells me to cut it every day.
Oh, I'm sure.
She tells me many things every day that I don't abide. but yeah, so now I've been wanting to, like, drop 10, 15 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm doing this on purpose.
Ooh.
'Cause I know it doesn't look good. So I'm saying I can't cut it until I lose the weight.
Whoa.
That way when I drop the weight...
You're going to look so fresh.
I'll emerge.
What, are you going to get a haircut too?
Yeah, I'm going to cut my hair too. I'm going to leave all this here.
Wow.
Or I might cut it tomorrow because I have a graduation to go to.
Or I might give up on all these goals and just do what I want. So I say instead of just cutting it all off and just shaving it how you normally keep it, you gotta play with that a little bit. Maybe have some chops.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
I saw this guy who had like his beard came to a point.
Yeah.
And cut in like that.
Ooh.
So, like, this stuff down here was gone, but it came to, like, he's a triangle.
He's pointing to his sideburns extending well into his cheekbones and then cutting down to his jawline.
Or what I want to do is trim this down, put a guard on, trim it down, and then, like, do the thin thing.
The chin strap?
Yeah.
Ooh. Classy. Do you ever watch Instagram videos of really good barbers and really good, like... Yeah.
All the time.
Groomers?
I guess so.
Is that what we're going to call them?
They make it look super easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's many things that I watch videos of online that people make look easy. And that's not how real life is.
No, not at all. Yeah, I need a haircut. Or I go to this spot down the street called Royal Barbers. And it's because it's next to a Royal Farm store. That's why it's called Royal Barbers. And a bunch of Vietnamese guys work there. And some of them speak English really well. And then some of them, there's a little bit of a language barrier there. So I'm never quite sure if I'm communicating in a way that really, like, lets them know what I'm looking for in a haircut. So I feel like I always walk in and it's a guess as to what I'm going to come out of there with.
I mean, do they have that thing on the wall, like the poster? Can you point to pictures?
Yeah, but they're all from 1982. They're pictures
they're all like Indian guys?
Yeah, right. And then there's the pictures of like Justin Timberlake in 1999 with his
ramen noodle
haircut. They're like, which one of these do you want? And I think, well.
Number 13.
Nice try. So next time I walk in and I look like... David Boreanaz from season 3 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That's that's where it's from.
There's this show on FX. Have you seen Atlanta? Donald Glover's show.
No, I like, haven't. You talk. You
dude, you
try
gotta
to
watch it.
Yeah,
it just.
I'm
just
sleeping on that one.
I just finished watching season 2 because I had a bunch on my DVR. And there's speaking about grooming, there's this episode where Donald Glover's cousin is this, like, rapper that's, like, he's, like, locally famous in Atlanta. He's, like, on the come up. And he goes, this other artist, this girl, who is, like, on the come up too, takes him out to this nail salon. And, like, they're getting a pedicure or whatever.
Okay.
And, he, you know, he's super uncomfortable and all this stuff. And she went off on a tirade talking about how, you know, how guys don't take care of themselves, how they don't groom themselves because it's viewed as, like, being gay or, you know.
It's soft.
It's soft or it's a feminine thing to do to, like, take time to groom yourself.
Sure.
How are you on the grooming tip, Dave? Are you, like, would you consider yourself
somebody not high polish
that pays attention to that like, you know. That's something that you're consciously thinking about.
I don't want to get into all the details of my grooming procedures, but I
walk
have
us
gotten
through. Walk us through you getting ready, Dave.
All right. So I got a very strict morning routine at this point. That includes after I wake up, I go downstairs, I start the coffee, and I use a French press. So what starting the coffee means is put the water in the kettle to boil.
You bring that up to a boil?
No. Sorry. It's just before boiling.
Okay.
But sorry, so after I put the kettle on, I'll take the beans, put it into the grinder, then take it downstairs into the basement so that I can grind it without waking up the house. So I grind the beans. After I grind the beans, I have enough time to go to the bathroom and brush my teeth. And then when I walk up the stairs, the pot is just before boiling. So I put the grounds into the French press, and then I add the hot water into the French press. And I take that into the living room and I set that to the side and I start my morning yoga routine and I do yoga for about 20 minutes.
Oh.
And so I have to interrupt my yoga to like do the press and like set that to the side. But that way my coffee is ready for me at the right temperature after I get done with my yoga.
So
and then
your yoga routine is like a few minutes?
20 minutes.
Oh, 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
So
yeah.
That
Yoga with Adrienne. I might have mentioned that before. She's my yoga
guru.
Yeah, she's my yogi, and she's awesome. And so So then after yoga's done, I have my first cup of coffee. So at this point, the only grooming that's happened is me brushing my teeth. In the first hour. So you asked about grooming. In the first hour of my day, like, I'll do a lot. Mm-hmm. But brushing my teeth is the only thing. And then I'll take a shower, maybe shave. I shave maybe every other day, every 3 days, mm-hmm. because I'm not, like, a crazy hairy man.
When I'm shaving,
I'm not plucking the eyebrows.
No.
But last time I went to the barber, they trimmed my eyebrows because I'm at the point in life where I'm getting old man eyebrows, and I've got a couple of strays that are these, like...
If you're getting strays in your eyebrows, are you also getting strays out of your ears, too?
No. No. No strays out of my ears.
Yeah. I get it bad coming out of my nose.
Yeah, the nose. Do you pluck your nose
Heck
hairs?
No, dude.
No?
I got this attachment for my, like, trimmers.
Uh-huh.
You're
investing some money in this grooming.
They're really ineffective.
Oh, okay. Does it ever
pull?
And
it takes forever.
Oh, okay.
No, it just tickles.
Yeah. There's no good way to deal with nose hair.
There's
no good
right?
way.
Right?
Have you... So, again, watching YouTube videos of grooming, because I do... And Instagram videos of grooming. Have you seen this black wax stuff that people put on their face?
Yes.
I've seen them cover a Q-tip with that black stuff, and they stick it up guys' noses, so when they pull the Q-tip out, it rips out a forest of nose hairs. And the guy's crying.
That sounds so painful.
Big dudes, just absolute tears.
I can't do that. I'm going to try something really quick.
Looks like we're pretty loud, huh?
I feel like we're spiking
the
bejesus out of this thing.
Let's see what happens.
Let me bring this down.
All right. We've been really loud up until now.
It's still there.
Please forgive us, because we're trying something new.
No, all right, here's something we've never done before. I'm going to cut and go back and hear this.
Okay, yeah. All right,
we'll
so
see.
Stand by. We'll see you in a minute.
Here's a short commercial break.
Because he is not that voice that feels sorry for you. He's the voice that believes that you are the head and not the tail, above only and not beneath. He is that voice that say, be healed. He is that voice that...
Hey, guys, welcome back. I went back and heard it, and it sounds great.
I'm glad these mics are working out.
I'm not going to lie. It sounds good. What were we saying? Grooming.
Yeah. So I just think before you completely shave and get back to the, like, crisp Dante that we know and love, I think you got to have a little bit of fun with that facial hair before...
I think so, too.
Before it disappears.
The thing about grooming that has made me mad for a lot of my life is, like, people, you know, kids in school used to tease me. Like, guys and girls used to always be like, oh, you're a pretty boy. I think the definition of a pretty boy is a guy that, and I'm not gay, but, like, a pretty boy is a guy that, like, invests a lot of time into his look.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
I think there was no
haircuts every week, you know, shaving and trimming and clipping the nails and, mm-hmm. like, or manicures and pedicures and, like, always, like, you know, clothes are always crisp, ironed, clean. And that was never me. You know what I'm saying? Like,
why would they call you the pretty boy then?
My mom would bark at me all the time about not, you know, clipping my nails and stuff. And, like, what? I'd let my hair get out of control. And it's like, boy, you need a haircut. I'm like, I know.
What leverage did they have on you then? Like, what were they trying to say that about?
I don't know. I don't know. I think, I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like
I can't say this in a way that doesn't sound arrogant or self-absorbed. I can't say this in a way that...
Just say it. Maybe because you're so good-looking.
No.
Maybe because I'm so... Never mind.
I think it's probably because I look like I do.
Okay, what... How is that not what I just said? Because you look... Like, because you're good-looking?
It may be because...
Because
like,
you're attractive...
Maybe because, how do you say that? How would you say it? How would you say it if you were trying to say what I'm saying? How would you say it?
I think you're... Wait, are you trying to say
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
How would you say it?
because I'm attractive.
That's how you would say it?
I might not say that.
No, I want to know what you would say. That's
why. Because
you didn't spend a lot of time grooming yourself, but people called you pretty boy anyway. Why is that? Why do you think people did that?
Because. it's hard to say. Why is it hard to say? Yeah, because I'm attractive. Because I think sometimes people consider me attractive. I feel like that's really sad that we have a hard time saying nice things about ourselves.
I'll never forget.
Or if somebody else says that they're attractive, that they might get hate because they acknowledge the fact that they're attractive.
I think there's a balance. Like, it's always okay to be self-deprecating in our culture. Like, it's always okay for some reason. And so you shouldn't be extremely self-deprecating all the time. That's just negative. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you obviously don't want to be in the other end of that spectrum. But I think that, and then, you know, a guy having that attitude about himself, you could argue is worse or not. I don't know.
I saw some traits
a picture about self-image that are like masculine and feminine.
It was somebody's yearbook picture of them in the yearbook, this girl, and what her caption was in her yearbook was, "This is to prove that my future kids that at one point I was hot." She was like a pretty girl, right? And so it was like a funny thing, but then posting it online, she got a lot of hate about her acknowledgement that she was attractive, even though it was said in a fun way, like not like a "I'm better than you," just acknowledging attractiveness. Yeah. I don't think people should be ashamed of that.
Yeah, while I believe that people should be confident in who they are and walk with this aura of confidence and comfort and security in who they are, I also think that the negative side of that is what's wrong with our culture and our society. The self-absorption that is just plaguing everywhere is the problem. Like, when people know they look good, you know what I mean? Like, you know, even people with talent, people that know they're talented, and you have to know mm-hmm. to continue to work at your craft and hone and improve and grow. But I think it just kind of varies on how you perceive yourself and what your attitude is that would either give room to facilitate growth in that area or stifle you. And you stop there. You stop in high school. You stop, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, there's an entire host of things that could play into that. But, you know, I was living in New York at the time, and, you know, I was in acting school, and I was, like, you know, a little worried about my image in a sense, because, like, your body is your livelihood, you know. Not in a weird way. But I remember walking. I used to be a waiter at a server at Applebee's.
Of course, Applebee's, fine establishment.
Fine dining experience. That was at the Applebee's in Times Square.
What kind of job requirements were, you know?
It was serious, man. There were maybe a dozen applicants, and a group of us that were interviewed. And they all led us through orientation, and we had a week of, like, shadowing and training on the floor.
Yeah.
And they only kept, like, three of us.
Wow. Exclusive bunch.
I think they only kept me because my friend worked there, and she got me in.
So...
I'm walking down the street, 42nd Street, after a shift, and I'm on the phone with my mom, and I'm like... We're talking about a bunch of other things, but I bring up, like, my teeth. Because I got this gap, and I've always been self-conscious about it, and I hate it. And I was, you know, among the other things we were talking about, I was like, yeah, and I want to get my teeth fixed, too, and blah, blah, blah. And she was like, why? And I was like, you know, this gap, I can't stand it, and, you know, I hate the way it looks. When I smile, I hate that it's there. And she was like, I don't think you have to worry about that. She's like, you have a beautiful smile.
Hmm.
And she's like, it's you. That was the first time in my life that maybe not the first time in my life, but it was the most profound and distinct moment that I can remember. Like, I remember that moment in time.
Yeah.
I remember that the phone up to my ear, and I remember being on that street and hearing that, where it was the first time that I accepted my gap, and mm-hmm. it was the first, you know what I mean? It was the first time that something that I dislike about myself was affirmed, and I was encouraged in a way where it could say, you know, yeah, I guess I agree with you. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I still don't even agree with you, but, like, thank you for... If someone in the world thinks that, then, you know, I think that... I don't have to continue to harp on the negative thing about it, you know?
Right. So self-confidence is important. Self-love is important. Just to love who you are in all that means. And you might have, like... attractive qualities change so much from generation to generation, right? Sure. Like what's attractive now was different than what was attractive in 1995, you know? Yeah. And what was attractive in 1995 is different than what was attractive in 1920. So like attractiveness is so subjective.
That's true.
I think self-love at any time is crucial, just to love who God's created you to be and what that's like. Cause even the attractive people, as you know, the youthful attractiveness that our culture celebrates, they grow up, they get old, you know, and our identity can't be, maybe that's it. Like when your identity is rooted in your attractiveness, that's what's a turnoff.
Yeah.
Right. So you take something that's an aspect mm-hmm. and you make it your identity,
yeah.
you get into a lot of trouble doing that across all sorts of things.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
That's not just about attractiveness and your own self-confidence, but that's about so many things when you take something that's an aspect of you mm-hmm. and then you make it your whole identity.
Right. Yeah. And like, you know, we've been talking about like gray hair and losing hair and over the last few episodes. And like, that's one of the things that, you know, a lot of times when I reveal my age to someone, they're like, what? You don't look like you're that old. And I get that a lot, you know, like, pretty regularly, I get carded at the movies.
At the
I
movies?
I don't even understand that.
The movies?
You like, to see a rated R movie, you have to be 17.
People are like, he looks 16.
You don't think I'm 7. That's just 30. That's what? Just stupid. Yeah. That's just insulting. But now, like, I got grays popping out, and I'm like... You know, it's like you have to, if you're not confident and secure in who you are, something like that, I could easily hinge myself on looking young and look, you know, I'm like not looking as old as I am. And I could pride myself in that and I can hinge my identity on that. Then as I inevitably age, how then does one navigate the truth of what's happening with the perception of who they are or who they present themselves to be to the world? Yeah. How do you navigate that? You know, like, and that gets...
And we're guys, right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
We're men, and the pressure on us aging is nowhere close to what it is for the ladies out there.
Oh, my goodness.
Look, like, guys, there's this avenue to get more distinguished with age. Mm-hmm. And women, I mean... I can't imagine how many billions of dollars are spent on the beauty industry that's targeted in making sure older women feel bad about getting older and missing their youth. When I wish there is a way, you know, for women to be affirmed more often in what it looks like to be beautiful as a 50-year-old, 60-year-old, 70-year-old. Like, that there's beauty at each stage.
Exactly.
And it doesn't have to be that 20, 30-year-old memory of who you were.
It's so unnecessary and stupid.
Yeah.
Like, that idea that beauty is youth.
Yeah.
You know? Like, that's so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I can't wait till my wife is, like, 50, mm-hmm. 60. She's going to be so beautiful. She's already so beautiful, mm-hmm. you know?
One of the, like, powerful verses that I think about often is in 2 Corinthians, where it says, though outwardly we are wasting away, inwardly we are being renewed day by day. Mm-hmm. Like, it's inevitable outwardly we're going to be wasting away. Look at anybody. The older they get, things just start breaking down. You talk to anybody who's over 50 and they'll tell you about the most recent breakdowns, you know? But there's so much more completeness that's available to us. So as that outward might, things might be breaking down, there can be an inward, valuable, quality that carries the outward in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love yourself, people. You look beautiful. You should say it, Dante. Dante, you should say it.
You beautiful. Remember, do you remember on Afternoon Snack, the white guy, his name was Kai. He had a bandana tied on. He was like a homeless guy, like a young guy. And he saw like this woman being harassed, and he attacked the attacker with a hatchet that he happened to have. You don't remember that video?
No. For anybody listening right now, they're just as lost as I am.
What happened today?
Well, went straight out of Dogtown, skateboarding, surfing it up. Before I say anything else, I want to say no matter what you've done, you deserve respect. Even if you make mistakes, you're lovable. And it doesn't matter your look, skills, or age, or size, or anything, you're worthwhile. No one could ever take that away from you.
I miss Afternoon Snack. It was a good time. But I've been dreaming about, like, producing online content more and more for our youth ministry. So more to come on that later.
That can be, you know, reintroduced.
Yeah.
You know.
Speaking of youth ministry, last night was a powerful night. We talked about racial injustice and how do we stand up and do what is right when we see wrongs happening. And we zoomed in on racial injustice last night. What was your perspective on that? So one thing for those that are listening, I just want to clue you in. It was me, a white guy, standing in a room full of about 100 people, and I was definitely the minority in that room. It was probably 80%, if not more, people of color. And I got a chance to share my heart and guidance. There were some directive words about racial injustice. And I shared some good stories and some failure stories on my part. Mm-hmm. It's kind of scary for me. It's uncomfortable to share failure stories of things that I've done wrong when it comes to race with a group like that.
I think what I enjoyed about your talk last night and what I thought was, you know, probably the most profound and palpable thing was how you used your experience and what you have as a person to make a difference, to inspire, to encourage, to have conversations. You use who you are and what you have to as tools to make a difference in whatever it is that you're doing. And I think that when you communicated that to the students, it gave, from what I got, I think it gave them a sense that it's possible for them, however small, however young, however under-resourced they may be, I think what you shared clued them in on the idea that they can, whatever it is that they have, that whatever privileges or resources or advantages that they have, or even their voice, they can use that in a way that that could, you know, cause a ripple effect of change in some way, somewhere, wherever it is that they are, you know. I think that's important, you know, because I think you can get lost in the anonymity of the world. You know, you're one person among, you know, 8-9 billion people. I don't even know what the world's population is anymore, but you're
seven-ish.
So you're one person among all those billions of people. So it's very, very easy to say, oh yeah, well, injustices are happening and war is happening and greed is, you know, is rampant and there's nothing I can do. It's so easy to take that position due to you being one person among billions, and it's easy to be invisible. It's easy to take that route. But I think what you shared is something very clear and distinct to say, you know, this is who I am, this is my experience, and this is what I can do. And it can make a difference. And that's the only way that it, that's the only way that change is going to happen, is when everyone takes up their part and decides to make those conscious decisions to better this planet and wherever they are. That's the only way.
And a lot of times it looks very small and minute and unimpressive. And the successes are very rarely headlines. And that can feel useless, you know, when you have a whole bunch of people working really hard and it seems like the impact is limited to just the couple of people around them that maybe notice, you know, maybe they don't even notice, but it takes a whole lot of people doing some very small, unimpressive things to shift our culture. And that's really cool that that came through, because, you know, my story's imperfect, you know, as many times as I might have something to brag about or, you know, to say I did right, there are things that I've done that have perpetuated stereotypes and perpetuated injustice or perpetuated biases that, man, it's the little things that really add up. And so putting myself under a microscope and helping other people do the same just to make small changes, that's a really big part of this battle.
Yeah.
So last night I mentioned that there are a number of times when something happens and my, like, something happens in our culture or community that highlights racial injustice, and my desire is to run toward it, just to put myself in the middle of moments where people are fighting for their voice and fighting for respect and where people are out to harm them. Wake up this morning and somebody texts me the latest news that at a local high school there were racial slurs spray painted on school property at a school right down the street from us. And so talking about racial injustice last night and then waking up this morning to see that, yep, it's not just the small stuff too. It's right here in the faces of our students that we work with every day. So yeah, so the N-word used to describe the principal of the local high school and swastikas and other homophobic slurs spray painted all across school grounds. And this is our world, you know, can't escape it. So
I didn't even hear that.
Yeah, Glenel. So not the first time they've dealt with something like that. So I've reached out to some people and I'll keep you guys updated on if I get a chance to speak into this one. But again, yeah, my first thought is how can I help create a space where people are valued and respected and voices are heard and communication happens across hurts like that. So,
oh gosh, that makes me so angry. Wow.
It's nonstop. And if schools aren't preparing for it now, when it hits them, they really have no excuse. With as much as it's like running rampant through our whole culture, they should be preparing now for when there's a flare-up, when there's a specific incident in their school that they have to address. So it's cool we get a chance to do some of that prep work, you know, you and I, as we get to speak into leadership programs and young people, and so.
It's crazy.
Well, to talk about another racial thing that's kind of at the forefront of the news yesterday, the NFL came out with their statement declaring that the national anthem should be, there are certain things that they want players to do during the national anthem. Up until now, there have been suggestions by the NFL, but no requirements. So they determined that players, before each game, as the national anthem is being played, either need to stand on the sidelines or stay in the locker room. No more kneeling allowed, punishable by fine for the team. Did you hear about that?
Not until you told me. So they still participate in the game. They're just still in the locker room while the national anthem is being played.
That's right. So they have two choices. No more coming out onto the field and taking a knee without without penalty. So the work that Kaepernick started and many other players took up that received tons of criticism over the past year and has cost the NFL, I'm sure, millions and millions of dollars with people boycotting the NFL on both sides. Some people boycotting it because players are kneeling, and some people boycotting it because of the backlash against those players. The NFL decided it's time to do something about this, and how are they going to respond as a business and as an organization? Because I'm sure it's motivated because they're losing money. And their conclusion was, you are no longer allowed to kneel as the anthem is being played. Gut reaction. I don't know.
There are certainly people in the stands that, you know, that don't stand during the national anthem.
Mm-hmm.
Some are consciously making a decision not to, and some just, you know, out of thousands of people, some just aren't alert or caring, you know. So since that happens every day at a sporting event and no one cares, it's because I guess they're the paying customer and they have the right to do whatever they choose. So it's not a big deal. But under that same lens of quote-unquote morality or what's right and appropriate for that setting,
mm-hmm.
how then do you hold the athletes, you know, under that same scope of accountability, you know, for something that you might not necessarily believe should be the blanket policy for everyone in attendance?
Right.
Is it unjust to mandate a paying customer to stand during the national anthem? You know, if so, there should probably be some consistency there.
Sure. Well, Section 301 of the United States Code, which deals with what to do when the anthem is being played, like there's actual code written down for this. It says this is what you should do. You should face the flag while standing at attention. Place your right hand over your heart and take your hat off. So standing is just one requirement. It's code. It's not like they can't fine a citizen for not following the code, but this is general practices, what shows respect according to U.S. code. But that's a number of different things, not just standing, but facing the flag and standing at attention. So not slouching, not fidgeting, place your right hand over your heart. Does everybody do that? And then take off your hat as well. So what the NFL has said about, well, previously in their code of conduct as it relates to making statements. Now, they didn't say anything specifically about the anthem, any requirements during the anthem before, but it according to 2017 NFL rules, they said throughout the period on game day that a player is visible to the stadium and TV audience, including the game warm-up, and while they're in the bench area, during post-game interviews, in the locker rooms, or on the field, players are prohibited from wearing, displaying, or otherwise conveying personal messages in either writing or illustration unless such a message has been approved in advance by the league office. And then follow-up things by a guy named Brian McCarthy, who is a spokesperson, said that players are encouraged but not required to stand during the national anthem. Now, that was previous to the declaration that happened yesterday. So it seems like what it is when the player is wearing the jersey and out on the field and making money for the team has a lot of say in how they act, you know, well beyond what the general citizen has the freedom to do. Like, you know, when you're living at home and your mom's paying your bills, she's got your cell phone bill and your car insurance bill, and every now and then she gives you some money for gas.
Yeah.
And she says, all right, be home by 11.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't have to follow your rules, right? She's like, well, I'm footing the bill for this thing.
Yeah.
Like, there, when you're in the system, there's somebody else that has say over how you act and how you carry yourself. So I think since teams were losing money, if they weren't losing money, I'm sure they wouldn't.
Were they losing money?
Yeah, with all the boycotts, like, people stopped, like.
Yeah, but were they losing money? How many people boycotted?
I think it was significant. I should have looked up those stats before.
I'm interested to hear that stat because, yeah. I mean, I don't think, I don't know. I'm ignorant in this, but.
It was definitely a lot of bad PR for the NFL, and they needed to address it, and that's what they determined.
Not bad enough.
So, I mean,
look at Kaepernick, who lost his livelihood.
Yeah, he's, you know, completely blacklisted.
They didn't lose that much compared to, you know, what someone on the other side of it, of things, lost.
Yeah.
But I think Kaepernick was using his platform to make a statement and to stand up for what he believed was right. So my guess would be then, on or off the field, on the field, you know, you can be Tom Brady. Off the field, you're still Tom Brady. Therefore, you could still garner the same response and platform from the same pool of people that look at you. So, you know, then could you, maybe the alternative, since that policy has been issued, you know, you can be more vocal and, you know, more intentional about what you say and do off the field.
Yeah, it's do it on your own time. It's like when you're wearing the jersey and you're on this field, you're ours, you know? Like, you play by our rules. I mean, as literally as that as we can get with that statement. And the NFL has had a long history with the military specifically. It's only as early as 2009 that players came out onto the field to stand. Did you know that?
Mm-mm.
That before 2009, they stayed in the whole team stayed in the locker room. Before 2009,
uh-huh.
And then except for the period right after 9/11. So right after September 11th, 2001, there's so much nationalism. Like, I remember it was like flags were hanging from every bridge. People were like so pro USA. And during the national anthem at football games, the players came out to the sidelines to stand for the anthem. But then they went, like, eventually as that drifted off, they went back into the locker room. And then in 2009, the policy came into place that players were encouraged to stand for the anthem. And so in 2009, that's this partnership between the NFL and the military has been like decades long. Back, just for another stat, back in 1991, the commissioner of the NFL said, "We've become the winter version of the 4th of July celebration," talking about the Super Bowl. Like, there's such an American football, red, white, and blue, USA, USA, attachment between this sport and not just the country, but support for the military. Mm-hmm. And it's just been ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. And now that there's a challenge to what patriotism looks like nobody's saying the NFL shouldn't be patriotic. Mm-hmm. It's just, the question is, what does it look like to be patriotic? Is it only channeled towards supporting threats that are foreign? Or is it also making sure we stand up against threats that are domestic. Like, it's that, what does it look like to be patriotic? And with this, such a close connection between the anthem, standing, NFL, military, when you challenge one aspect of that, it's assumed that you're throwing out all of it.
I don't think we should play the national anthem at sporting events anyway. What does a sporting event have to do with
That's
do you know that?
Well, it started back in World War I, even before it was considered the national anthem. It was during the seventh inning stretch of a World Series game that is kind of spontaneously was played during a baseball game, and it caught on, and it was this national pastime of baseball, and it just seeped into every other sporting event. But baseball is even, we don't call it American baseball. Baseball's all over the world. But football, that's American football. That's, if you take that nationalism pride of USA and what makes us distinct, football is one of those things. So if you're going to be pro USA on anything, football is a main stage for that because it is ours. You know, that is one thing that we claim just to ourselves. In 2014, there was this guy named Michael Shotley. He wrote for Bleacher Report. And this is 2014, right? Mm-hmm. Before Kaepernick, before all of this, who wrote this really awesome, almost prophetic article exposing and challenging the connection between military and football, the NFL specifically, right? Mm-hmm. So really like trying to pull this apart and wondering how did it get so closely tied together? And he said, he was the one that said, no one has a problem with the NFL being patriotic. It's the homogenized, one-size-fits-all brand of sterilized patriotism that rubs people the wrong way. And those are harsh words, like, right? Like saying that the patriotism that's displayed and encouraged is only one side of what it means to be patriotic for our country. Now, the NFL's done awesome things for troops all around the world. As they're out on the front lines of battle, there's through the USO, they offer a lot of support. Through Wounded Warriors, they offer a lot of support. They do a lot of things that never hit the headlines.
Right.
But during the games, the flyovers, the color guard, the huge flag, the spotlight on certain military members, it's a very one-size-fits-all version of patriotism. And so it complicates things a lot when a person like a Kaepernick or the many others that followed in his footsteps, it gets really complicated when they say, I'm being patriotic, but I'm expressing it in a different way. Even in that 2014 article, he said, what would happen if the NFL games started without the national anthem? He said, people would go crazy. Like, people would have no part of it because they are so intertwined. You wonder, like, why is this nationalism and patriotism and display, why is that attached to the sport and game of football? And the DOD, they've shelled out millions to football, to the NFL and to teams throughout the years. Now they aren't anymore, after it was exposed by McCain a couple years ago, mm-hmm. that they were giving money to the NFL. But they're doing free flyovers and free performances. And
how much are those flyovers? Yeah. How much do those cost?
Yeah. And it's all PR, right? So the military has their PR, the NFL has their PR, and it's a really close partnership. A really close partnership, and both of them have been benefiting for years and years and years. And now we're at the point where it's not benefiting everyone anymore. And so now that that benefit is in jeopardy, they're saying, let's tighten up the ship because we're not leaving this partnership behind. So NFL is making a very strict declaration that we are keeping our partnership of this support for the troops, military, USO, wounded warriors, supporting the troops overseas, and it will be displayed in this very certain way. We're not going to mix messages one bit. This is what it looks like. Stand or stay in the locker room or get fined.
You know what that's reminiscent of? And if I'm wrong, I don't care. But that's reminiscent of Charlottesville, Virginia, where there was a move to take down the statue of the Confederate general and uproar. That's a part of history. It's America. And you saw, through events, you saw what happened. People clinging to the past, if there were a statue of Stalin or Hitler still erect and there was a move to tear it down, would a former Nazi have the same zeal and go out with torches and protesting and would that happen? So then a general who fought on the side of history that would obviously be out of the question today, although it's still a part of history, why should that statue remain? Why is it such a controversial thing to do? Why is it wrong to do? Why is it un-American to do, to tear that down, when everything that general stood for and through our moral scope is wrong? I think in that same way, we're holding on to that ritual. It's a ritual. With the Star-Spangled Banner at the beginning of the game, it's the only reason we do it is because it's a ritual. It originated in World War One, and it leaked out into other sports, and it's just ritualistic. And to think and to even suggest that maybe we make a move to not do it, oh, that's un-American. That can't happen.
I think one thing that what you're saying highlights is if we're going to talk about what it means to be a true patriot, there are a lot more significant things that the everyday American can do that are so much greater than doing a ritualistic stand during a song being played. What is the most patriotic thing somebody can do? Is it simply having a flag in their front yard? Is it having a lapel pin that has the flag on it? Some of these guys writing these articles about this issue have mentioned things like this, right? And it's really saying what are we communicating? Because first off, when a person challenges a ritual and challenges a system like Kaepernick and the other players are doing, they're trying to communicate something. Are you listening? Like, are you listening to what they're saying? Mm-hmm. It's hard when your emotions react to it and you're like, but if you're kneeling, my brother's serving overseas and like he came back with one leg and you're not respecting the sacrifice that he made. Like the emotions that come up in a person like that block them from listening to the message of the other person. In a similar way, the emotion of kneeling and sacrificing your entire career for the message and rights that you want to communicate, it's hard to listen to the other side to realize what a venerated and deeply meaningful moment that is to a lot of people that mm-hmm. that are they listening. So I feel like there's a lot of the moment has definitely happened where the system has been challenged, the anthem, the ritual of it has been exposed as a platform for a lot of different messages, mm-hmm. question is, are people listening to the messages being sent, or are we just all trying to talk louder, trying to communicate our own?
Yeah.
Now, with the NFL making this decision, I'm curious to see how this is going to play out, because there are a lot of people who are not happy about it, and equally there are a lot of people that are extremely happy with it, thinking this is taking care of it. And what I would encourage you guys to do, no matter where you are on this topic, is one, acknowledge the hurt of the other side. And for me, who has a lot of friends on both sides of this issue, really, you have to have a starting place of acknowledging the hurt on the other side. Mm-hmm. And if you can just do that as a starting point, imagine the bridges that you're building, and you're building an ally just in saying, I hear your pain on this, and it means something to me. And feel that with them. Try to put that into words and see what happens as your starting point for the conversation. Speak their hurt back to them and let them know that you're listening. And maybe that can be a great point for a starting conversation.
Agreed.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
This stuff isn't going away, Dante.
Instead of being angry about someone kneeling during the national anthem, why don't you be angry about lives that are lost? You know, why don't you show that same anger towards the systemic oppression that has been prevalent for the entire history of this country, you know? Instead of crucifying and castrating Michael Vick for dogfighting, which is illegal, I'm not validating or excusing his crimes. People were irate, angry, ravenous, wanted his head. More, you know, consideration and heartbreak was directed at the loss of the lives of dogs than the lives of black men and women.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, I just think that so much energy is displaced and misplaced in the wrong place, in the wrong areas. And however, 50 years ago, conversations like this, you and I, wasn't happening that much. So, you know, this is the start, I believe, of that change. This is the catalyst of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway.
I hear you.
Yeah.
And I hope others do too.
Hope so. I wanted to talk about hockey. Maybe we'll get into them next week, because I need to do my
research.
Now
that we talk about black people stuff, let's talk about some white people stuff.
We'll get into this next week, because I got to do some homework, but why is fighting allowed in hockey?
They were going at it last night. The Caps in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Go Caps. But you know what? Yeah.
So
if hockey was a predominantly black sport, would the fighting be as accepted?
Dude, if two big black dudes were punching each other in the face on a basketball court, like two big grizzly white dudes do on the ice, it would not be perceived in the same way. It would not be perceived in the same way.
That's all I'm saying.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. We love you. Reach out to us. We want to hear what you have to say about all this.
Do it, Dave.
Adios.